Of course, the thing we know from, you know, the farmers of 40 centuries is it's the footprint of the farmer that drives the care and attention, the diversity, the management, the love that heals land.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Welcome. Today's conversation is with Severin von Charner. Welcome. She is the founder of Agrarian Trust, Greenhorns, FarmHack, many different projects and organizations. She is an organizer and a farmer herself. Severin was one of my earliest influences in this space. So what a privilege it was to sit down now and have this discussion with her. We go into things like land use transition, funding the farmers movement, algae, and many other topics. Severin has a humorous, playful, eloquent way of articulating herself. I promise you will enjoy it. Let's dive right in with Severin von Charner. Welcome. Today we're here with Severin von Charner. Welcome. Thanks, Severin, for doing this.
Right on.
Severin is a farmer. She is the founder of Agrarian Trust. She is a founder of many other projects and organizations, which we'll get into. And we're happy to have you in Aotearoa, New Zealand right now.
In the glorious rain.
Yes. How's your visit been so far?
Wonderful. Glorious. Beautiful. Mm. Verdant.
Any other adjectives you'd like to throw out there?
So much potential for restoration. So much roadside vegetative abomination with the herbicides in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So much normative, erosive road cut, land violation everywhere. It's like very abrading to those of us in the eco space, I think. Like, you, it's gorgeous, and it's also massively an ecology of invaders. And then these weird phalanxes of willows and poplars. This is kind of Hobbit universe, little. It's very strange. Like, Bermuda had a baby with whales, but then it was all this like super limited palette of trees that were painted on with a brush. Anyway, these are very unpolitically correct statements, I'm sure, but it's shocking every time.
Yeah. Well, this is a safe space. Yeah. I think one of the reasons I love speaking with you and I'm excited about this conversation is you have such a beautiful marriage between language and ways of seeing that are not common. And help people understand maybe what that originates in and from, and like your broad strokes, background, and journey, maybe to set some context.
Just to say, that was all like punchy and critical, but I think also the leadership of New Zealand in so many realms, from being kind of alone as a little island, having to hack it by itself, and this very tough culture of human that has to be able to survive here, you know, is also should be mentioned in the same sentence. But I've been an organizer for as long as I've been, you know, living out of my parents' house and around food and farming. And it's a good culture of people who are getting into agriculture. It's a very compelling way of life, world to be in. And a big part of the work that I've approached is how do we make it super fun and welcoming? And so I think languaging and making visible the culture, making accessible the culture, bringing in all the intersectional flavors of that, helping to kind of bring in voices and illuminate pathways and map out patterns and cultivate in others kindness and sharing and team spirit to welcome in yet another group, that essentially it'd be very lonely if we all have to live far away from any other people doing what we're doing, organically farming, surrounded by, you know, what is increasingly an aging rural population in most parts of the world. So building a fun youth culture is the goal. And then of course fun is, or romance or valor or purpose or reform-mindedness is one aspect. And then having the stamina to stick with it when inevitably, you know, your pencil gets sharpened by adversity, mm-hmm. an unending, you know, heartbreak that is agriculture, and agriculture particularly as practiced in this world of hyper-globalization, you know, is definitely an endurance game for everybody who participates in that. It's not just fun, it's also critical for survival. And then another part of it is, if we're talking from a financial perspective, the people who are choosing to get into agriculture are obviously ignoring market signals, because every market signal would tell you this is not the correct place to put your life's energy, and that the wages are too low, and that the price of land is too high, and that the pathways to markets are obstructed by extraordinarily, deliberately impenetrable thickets of regulation to thwart you. So on that sense, there's this, you know, you're in a kind of mafia of people who are all, you know, operating on a different octave, kind of vibrationally, and who have to, you know, get through the world in sloppy but efficient ways or intuitive ways, mm-hmm. because, you know, if you look at the math, you know, fully, it kind of doesn't make sense. And yeah. yet you have extraordinary people flowing in, mm-hmm. and the extraordinary community of sustainable agriculture in this country, I know from my experience in your world, mm. certainly in the U.S., we just come back from Italy. We had an international convening of farm hack, open source farm technology groups from around the world. So, you know, one thing I can say for sure is it's great people.
So help people understand where you're located and what you're up to. And maybe, you know, we won't go through necessarily the full detailed biography, and people can get it in other places, but yeah, a little bit at a high level of the projects you've been involved in to help set the scene.
Sure. Well, so I'm a farmer with my husband in Maine. We have a very diverse homestead looking out over the sea. We grow herbs and flowers and vegetables, and we do a lot of harvesting from the wild. So I'm very fascinated with algae. And then we process those things because we live very big distance from cities and people. So then we make, you know, seaweed sprinkle and blueberry jam, and we run a grocery store, and we run camps and camping and workshops and festivals. Now more even residencies, we host kind of a lot of collaborators. We have a 9,000 book library in an old Oddfellows Hall.
Beautiful.
So I kind of found a little corner of the world that was very remote, but also very affordable, within which to host kind of the elements of a good life and of an institution that supports this work in a grounded way. Mm-hmm. And the work has been for, you know, 16 years now, published, you know, basically multi-format publishing and cultural production for Greenhorn. So literary journal, documentary, you know, 9 years of radio podcasts. Now we're doing another series with the Bioneers called The Desert is Coming. Lots of workshops and parties and conferences and symposia and guidebooks and posters and digital maps and, you know, any way that we can figure out how to enliven this world of new mm-hmm. farmers, we try it. And then sometimes they fall off the internet because we forgot the password. But so Greenhorns began quite a while ago, and then out of Greenhorns has grown other elements of the work. So the Young Farmers Movement then kind of needed a policy arm to advocate within, you know, federal farm bill allocations at the beginning, and then also at state ag department level. And so the National Young Farmers Coalition started 2 years later, and I was the founding board member, board president of that. That's now in all the states and has been extremely effective at raising the issue of next generation kind of policy demands. And I'm super happy to see that the New Zealand policy statement coming out with shared vision for what we all need as our common ground, which is a functional uplands for our water and food shed for our resilience as a society. Mm. And it shouldn't be a matter of politics. it's absolutely an issue that we all share and need practically to work together on. So that acknowledgement is pretty fundamental. But so anyway, we started National Young Farmers Coalition. Then we wanted to have more of this open source farm technology be available. And so then FarmHack was born, and then Agrarian Trust really started as a call for solutions to land transfer. And talking, you know, as it goes in the nonprofit world, you have to talk about a problem a lot to try to rouse the support mm-hmm. for it to get solved mm-hmm. and, you know, go onto the mountaintop and make a compelling case. Mm-hmm. And so we did that. And interestingly, Agrarian Trust just got a $12.9 million grant from the USDA for BIPOC farmland purchase. So Agrarian Trust is an organization to decommodify land, to take it out of the private property regime and hold it in community land trust with community governance for permanent agroecological stewardship, which is kind of a set of like constraints on what its use will be. Mm-hmm. So in the kind of age of dominion and commodification of land, you have the right to destroy, the right to extract, the right to mine, the right to intensify and have monoculture. But in the agrarian trust kind of framing, you have a right for regeneration, you have a right for restoration, for, you know, hedges and improvements, for polyculture, for local food access, for education. So you're setting a framework around how that land will be held, such that it's a kind of a spiritual home for its surrounding community of eaters. And it's not just, oh, they have access, they can produce calories, you know, although that is true, you know, beets contain calories. But, you know, it's a heartbeat. It's a place where children are in relationship with nature. And, you know, ask anyone when they smell hay, you know, do they think of kittens? If they grew up in a relationship with working land, that was absolutely, you know, a portal for love of the world that they crawled through, you know, in the barn. And so recognizing how profound it is to have access, intimacy, shared space with the source of our food, I think is a kind of cultural realization that is starting to be more widely recognized.
And you shared yesterday that once you do have something like a farm in the middle of a community with community access and ownership, rather than this privatization and, you know, mono, industrial, agro, whatever, that other things follow on. Can you share more about that?
Well, so we have kind of eight projects that are now established, eight commons, eight agrarian commons. And some of them were new, bringing, you know, new farms arising from, you know, what had been like a degraded pasture. Others of them were established organic farms that had a good track record of training young people into farming and had already, you know, 250 CSA shares and barns mm-hmm. and picnic tables and whatever. So different kind of forms. But apart from just the trend, like supporting, resourcing, and facilitating the transition of these parcels, these kind of farm organisms, it's also the new behaviors of people having to take responsibility outside of their role as a kind of purchaser, taxpayer, or kind of transactant in the world. And this caretaking and, you know, membership behavior, I think, was more familiar in previous historical times than it is to the current generation of kind of weird, wired Western, alienated from land, alienated from many of the traditional institutions of shared purpose, generation of which I am a part, or you are a part. Many of the people who are watching videos on the internet may identify with themselves, the fact that they, you know, don't necessarily go to church, don't necessarily participate in a, you know, a skating club or a grange or a quilting club, or, you know, even necessarily spend that much time at their public library. So that kind of disintegration from institutional community participation, community membership, and showing up, holding up together. Mm-hmm. The holding up together, the kind of yes and let's get this, we have got to figure out how to get the roof repaired on our shared hall, or who's going to cook the pancakes at the pancake breakfast, or, you know, how do we break down all the tents after our annual harvest festival? These are not just about getting the tables up and down. This is also learning each other's strengths and being in deep relation. So as much as the community finance is important for purchasing farms, the community enlivenment and community relatedness and community intimacy that comes from having to deal with problems is a really important kind of side outcome or parallel outcome for commoning land. Mm.
And so much of the...
Don't use the word committee. Sorry, so much of the...
So much of your work has been predicated on this big transition of land that's upon us and that's happening right now. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, well, we have a big problem in the world, and that is the financialization of land. You know, first the settlement conquest and deforestation and domestication of landscapes caused injury to the land and its health and its resilience and its capacity to hold water and life and organic matter. But then now increasingly the price going up, ticking up, ticking up, that every farm is valued as its maximum holiday home potential, or, you know, as a racetrack or an airport. The farms are valued so highly by our economy and speculation and financialization, intensification, consolidation have been a kind of project of the last century. But obviously, COVID also drove more flight from the cities. And those places that are close to cities became, even more expensive if you were trying to buy a farm. So buying a farm is basically not within the wherewithal of most people. So when you look at how are young people able to get into farming, they're mostly coming in through apprenticeships, becoming then, you know, into management. At a certain moment, there's a leap of starting one's own enterprise. There's often rental. There's often supplemental income. There's often terrifying debt. Meanwhile, the land wants to be farmed correctly. You know, the humans and the other creatures with whom we share this beautiful earth need this land to be cared for by the stewards and who share its best interest. And there's lots of people, I wish there were more institutions to point to for, you know, assertively reformatting the relationship of stewardship and access. Mm-hmm. Agrarian Trust obviously advocates and enacts one very public version of that as a kind of performance art of commoning. I have a wonderful friend, Omar, who wrote in the last New Farmer's Almanac his vision for starting with power lines. Power lines already get easements across land, but that you can imagine those easements that migratory routes and habitat refugia for foxes and quail and other birds, native pollinator habitat, et cetera, could also, you know, kind of penetrate the private property matrix in ways that were guided by ecological need, by hydrologic, kind of geomancy. And so, for instance, in the world of Iowa, where he is, you've got corn, soy, corn. If you ever want to bring cows into that landscape, there need to be places where cows don't sink into the mud of that over-tilled soil. So if you made like a power line easement, but for a perennial polyculture of native prairie flowers and forbs, not only would it be great for the bugs and the birds, and, you know, the salamanders, I'm sure, but also you have a place where the cows can actually walk on to get between pastures. Mm-hmm. So it's that dire in terms of, you know, dragging ourselves out of these absolutely doomed systems that are absolutely destroying the life of our land. And unfortunately, there's expedient, profitable proposals being made to kind of spray GMO microbe, all yeah. sorts of ideas that are kind of drone and techno mega kind of solutioneering mm-hmm. that tend to draw the eye and the investment dollar. And of course, the thing we know from, you know, the farmers of 40 centuries is it's the footprint of the farmer that drives the care and attention, the diversity, the management, the love that heals land. So it's not a kind of point and click, copy and paste situation. Mm-hmm. It's really a resettlement and a integration of human and ecological interest. But of course, that requires brave, hardworking humans to go do it. And it's hard work. So what's the point? The point is, as a society, it is critical that we support, accompany, facilitate, enable this migration into stewardship. And that beautiful talent that comes out of schools and or doesn't go to schools could flow into this work and not be bottlenecked by the impossibility of financial access.
And as I understand it, we have a lot of farms that are looking for that next generation stewardship as people get older, retire, and pass. And so, yeah, can you share?
Well, the scale of the issue is kind of terrifying. It's 400 million acres in the next 20 years, and that was already 5 years ago statement. Mm. So it's kind of like we did a visualization, and it was, you know, the size of the Louisiana Purchase is transitioning.
In the United States.
In the United States. So it's an extreme amount of, you know, acreage. The demand is there. There are amazing organic farmers retiring. There's a kind of lump of them. There's like a demographic pulse. Mm. This thing you might have heard of, the Back to the Land movement. Some of them extremely successful businesses that are being run by people who are, you know, in their mid and late 70s and who really deserve to retire in dignity and who often struggle to figure out how to do that, navigate that financially mm-hmm. and be able to, you know, live in their own home as they age, bring on someone new, repair critical things on the farm. Then you have, a lot of demand to go in. We at Agrarian Trust, we have had success. This big federal grant, we raised all this money and purchased all these lands, the little Juba purchase for the Somali Bantu refugee community in Maine was a great example. 1,700 donors putting in little bits would have been great for your quadratic funding thing to purchase this land to be held forever for agroecological farming for the Somali Bantu community. And however, there's so much more we could be doing. So many more beautiful deals are coming to us saying, oh my God, you guys have the solution. And we're like, we are limited. So the, you know, resource limitations are kind of heartbreaking once you put yourself out as a helper. Yeah. And then you find that the wound is so great.
Really resonates in the philanthropic side of things. Once you put yourself out there as, you know, hey, there's some resources. It's just like you're just exposed to the pain and suffering and scale of the challenge. So you mentioned Agrarian Trust, 8 of these agrarian commons now, and you know, just also having witnessed you on the journey, like, congratulations, you should be so proud. And you know, it's just, it's a beautiful thing we've done, even in our tiny little scales.
Well, and full disclosure, the beginning support of that happened from Namaste and now Biome. So, you know, it doesn't happen without.
Yeah,
some we were bros. Just
one of those small contributors along the way, and it was based on, you know, watching your work with Greenhorns and just clear, obvious, you know, proof that you were a force to be reckoned with, and whatever you were sinking your teeth into next was going to be successful in whatever expression it found. And so yeah, just, you know, privileged to be able to be useful in the movement through such a simple thing like contributing a little financial resourcing. But what I wanted to ask you is, you referenced Agrarian Trust as kind of you know, in some ways like performative art. And then yet you also now, congratulations, have received, you know, a more significant grant for the life cycle of this organization. I assume that's kind of the biggest, you know, chunk to ever come in. And so how do you think about, you know, is the pathway like, okay, here's how we're going to, you know, go from 8 to 80 to 800, or is this model, you know, farm by farm still needing kind of a different, you know, meta strategy and rethink to really get it at a larger scale? Or is that the wrong way to think about it? Because this is really about replication and, you know, trying to open source the blueprints, if you will, of the legal and financial commonsing activities. Or yeah, how do you think about it?
Well, that's another reason for transparency and kind of a cultural method is that, you know, a grant trust is not Adobe software. You know, we're not going to be able to solve all your office needs. And ultimately, the wherewithal needs to arise in multiple locations, each suited to their own place, where people participate in their own survival, cultural, ecological, agricultural survival,
right,
by holding the land. We can show how that happens. We can study how it happens. We can facilitate it happening. We can, you know, bring the awesome lawyers, learn from each of these cases, transmit that, you know, through kind of information sharing networks and like best practices, farmer to farmer, you know, and have the word spread which it has. The word is absolutely spread. Look to community solutions, look to community finance, you know, to solve the unsolvable problem that you face with financialized farmland, you know. But then, you know, what are the instructions we have from life? It's to respond in situ to the stimulus, the crisis, the need that we are physically with in the landscape. So yeah, we have to scale more, sure. And thanks to you having, you know, written checks that were bigger than what little startup nonprofit land trusts can usually get in a nonprofit kind of culture, more entrepreneurial, like, okay, you know, let's go type of a chunk. That obviously helps a lot. And I want to say more kind of entrepreneurial foundation actions can help these weirdo solution structures get going. And obviously, yeah, having some credibility from other gigs helps that. But I mean, I've said it before, we need 10,000, you know, forms to be brought forward. But they probably will share a lot. They will all share the fact that more people need to be participating in food production. More people need to be participating in community finance. More people need to commit to chewing the food, to eating foods that aren't already pre-chewed through a factory and through a big Tupperware that came on a pallet into some Mylar pouch. You know, if you actually want the land to be healthy, then, you know, you're going to have to get out your knife, dear generation who's eating while they're watching videos. And I think that commitment, you know, is reflected also in the financial realms. But that's like major behavior change. My hope is that the people who are now newly rural or semi-rural, which is, again, this kind of consequence of flight from cities, are basically now newly in a rural context. That's definitely the case in Maine. We had a huge migration to my home state during the pandemic, people from all over, and, you know, a lot of them with great skills. I mean, you know, cultural sector, from a lot of people from California, essentially kind of climate and professional refugees, early edge of saying, oh my God, I'd like to live in this very beautiful, sparsely populated, forested, full of water place. Well, earn your way into the heart of a community that has withstood tremendous stresses and has withstood youth departure and has had extraction of lumber, extraction of fish, extractive of potatoes and, you know, arsenic contaminated water from the chicken barns and whatever the legacy of destruction has been in the rural area where you happen to now be,
right,
where sprawl pressures are going to be coming, then if you're a factor in healing, a factor in holding, accompanying, bringing talent, I mean, no new farmer that I know doesn't have someone who shows up for bookkeeping, childcare, graphic design, web help. There's so many ways to like support mm-hmm. a local food business, not even, you know, financially and non-financially. Mm-hmm. And then binding together the kind of crystal pattern of a new business, a new food farm business, where there's all these forces coming, you know, mm-hmm. that's our survival.
Right.
Being part of these crystals, being relationally bound up in one another's destiny. And the information moves beautifully where you have that, where you have that level of connectivity. Information that is needed in a crisis. Information that is needed to spark and inspire. Information that's used to intuit and develop and innovate and incite and welcome and attract. You know, a community that knows where it's going and what it wants can conjure a baker, can conjure, you know, somebody to do butchery, can call in an evolving and improving local farm economy. And so, you know, that's like my request is, you know, if you want it, like make it. Mm-hmm. It's all organizing.
Yeah, beautiful.
And which you are doing here.
Yeah, we're trying.
But we have to get more people doing it everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is that it's not super obvious that, you know, you can, that the agency does exist. Sorry, back to you.
There's so many barriers that, you know, there's all of these different, you know, things you're alluding to in terms of cultural and social change that has to happen. And I want to, you know, focus a bit more on the finance piece, just because that's kind of the thing we're trying to really, you know, continue to press on, even though it's just one of many of the challenges. And
the earth is paved. How do the dandelions penetrate through the pavement? Well, we had a really nice conversation earlier. I mean, I don't know, this is 12 years ago, with a guy who had also been a tech bro guy. And then he made Kiva, which was doing kind of micro lending in mostly Africa at that point for women to buy a sewing machine or whatever. And we young farmers were at the time trying to kind of liberate federal loans, what's called FSA, Farm Security Administration loans. That was a Roosevelt era program that were often blocking organic people or diversified market people and saying like, oh, well, cabbage is only worth 13 cents a pound. So I don't see how it pencils out for you to, you know, get $2.50 a pound for it or, you know. So access to those loans was challenging. And when the Kiva guy was like, yeah, let's make it so you can have 0% interest, $20,000 loans for young farmers, and then they can crowd, you know, support the kind of quadratic e-resourcing of that, or and then pay back. And then we lengthened the payback term a little bit. It was like long enough for a piglet, you know, to be weaned. But anyway, that getting that money from outside of the traditional ag sector and bringing it into the kind of politics, the political appointee of FSA, allowed them to say, to be forced to say yes. So I think part of the ecology that I'm understanding, financial ecology I'm understanding, is if you can kind of provoke and incite the quite conservative forces, the conservative norms of the way that finance flows, that can be effective, an effective strategy. So, but let me say that more succinctly, capitalizing farms is challenging. Accessing land is challenging, but, you know, small chunks of low interest money for things like greenhouses, loading docks, packing sheds, you know, washing and packing with sinks and being able to get it into a bag and bubbling the water up through and getting into, be able, you know, if you want a cash flow, then lettuce is the way to go, you know, or eggs. And there's wonderful teachers on the internet who will help you, you know, Jean Martin is a wonderful one in market gardening, Richard Perkins on the chicken front. I mean, there's just an extraordinary accessibility of the kind of top Renaissance wizards of the financial and the ecological management.
Right.
Small farm dream.
Right.
Like never has it been easier to find the information on how you could go about this. But you still need to pull together 20 grand, you know, for a nice wash packs area.
Right.
And, Yeah. So even at the lower end of what it takes to get these farms off the ground, there's major limitations for accessing that cash.
Yeah. Yeah. And you and I share this, like, what I would consider a bias towards bottoms up kind of approaches, even the way you're articulating the in this conversation, but also the way that Agrarian Trust has approached it. And yet you're also, you know, pulling in this kind of more traditional top-down, larger pool of funding more recently. And you've obviously thought about things at kind of nationwide policy levels. Yeah, like looking at it from more of the larger, you know, institutional flows of capital. And maybe I'll specifically ask a question that, like, I've been like wrestling with this year, which is, I had a conversation with someone that I had only just met, and they had only just recently become a trustee of an only, you know, just recently formed very large pool of philanthropic capital coming out of technology, of course. And they were struggling to figure out how to allocate it. So in many ways, it was like the dream come true, kind of like huge dislocation of capital on a spend down kind of timeline, trying to find ways to support the climate crisis. And it's so striking because you spend all day, you know, with these EDs and nonprofits and land projects and farmers and organizations who are just trying to scrape whatever they can find together. And then you have this conversation with someone who can't find large enough catchments to receive the funds, and a struggle to actually match the kind of local scale with the large pools. And I was left with this feeling that as we go into potentially kind of an accelerated set of crises, and not just inequality, but also the urgency of just like huge weather events and huge displacements of peoples and huge, you know, crops and harvests lost, that kind of mismatch may also accelerate. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, like in my mind, Agrarian Trust is actually kind of really important middleware infrastructure that continues to learn a lot of important lessons and show what kind of some of the financial and legal machinery could look like. But I'm curious, yeah, what that brings up for you and commentary on kind of that dynamic.
Absolutely. I mean, capacity building, facilitating, you know, education for young people who want to get into this, onboarding small capital, you know, growing the entrepreneur world, supporting the cultural life of small places such that they're attractive. I mean, that's the thing. Bottom up is not, that's where, you know, that's because life goes against the force of gravity and creates elegance from sunlight. Life of necessity begins at a small point, and each seed has autonomy. Each farmer, each entrepreneur, each place, each river, you know, undertakes its own slalom. And I think there are baked in assumptions that come as soon as you have this mega reservoir of cash, of you know, any concentration. Richard Heinberg did a book on power recently from the Post Carbon Institute, and looking at, you know, the mechanical power of a dam across a river, for instance, versus the ecological power of the river and all the energy path of that meandering river and the fish rushing up it and the like moving of the phosphorus upstream from the bones of the animals and the bears and the eagles who are eating the flesh of the fish that are coming from the sea. And that the majesty, the magnificence is one part, but also just the metric scale of power is so much bigger when the river is flowing freely than when you can just catch it and, you know, the run a couple whirligigs. And so, you know, the good news is there are tremendous amounts of people who are in a position to use this cash. And so, you know, apprenticing oneself if one is in the position to distribute financial capital, apprenticing oneself to the practitioners who have already played this field and, you know, yielding and being more humble and not trying to set up yet another, you know, effing whole nother, you know, competition and fancy websites and, you know, massive amounts of master's degree, white people clickety clacking on computers to, I mean, it's really frustrating how, you know, pompous it can get in the world of all this mega cash. And meanwhile, you have these extraordinary social movements via Campesina, for instance, who have a membership, a civil society process, principles, policy, you know, the farmers union in the United States. You have amazing of shared need, shared analysis, a policy vision, you know, areas of focus. Like the work has been done to discern and to lay out the agendas. And so, you know, please help those guys, you know, find the pathways, because we need to break it into rivulets, that stream. And urgently, we have to move that cash out into the good work. Urgently, we do. And then there's the part of that that happens kind of extra bodily, you know, through checks and donations. And then there's also the opportunity to, you know, wherever it is that you are, invest in the food shed. You know, who are the people who are producing the food? Who needs a grain mill? Who needs a walk-in cooler? You know, what is the investment that can happen within your, you know, region that strengthens the region? And I think that those kinds of partnerships can be extremely rewarding, because then you have the donor cultivating greater insight and having a feedback loop and learning from, you know, the kind of physicality of the problem. Because the thing is, it's food is physical. So there's a other part of it, which is like getting out of the cerebral, you know, hyper realm, which is what comes with extreme wealth. A lot of hyper realm, and getting back into like, what do I observe? What is the land saying? Where is health? That level of responsivity is what keeps those of us who farm happy. You know, tending to 10,000 seedlings every spring. Yeah, it's work. They have to be watered every day. But joy, absolute joy. And when I go to the city and give talks, and then the teachers are all saying, oh, the kids are depressed. It's like, oh my God, we've got to get these kids in a greenhouse. You know, there's just no way to be depressed when you're watering seedlings. On all levels, moving it out into the physical, moving the spirit into relationship with life will help for all of that, for all the parts of that.
Now, I'll stop asking you about money. I want to ask you about algae.
Oh, good.
Why algae?
Algae is a world maker. You know, cyanobacteria were the ones who figured out this thing called photosynthesis, converting sun's energy into carbon. And then, of course, as a substrate for other forms of life, and of course, the oxygen that comes out, kicks out, that makes the atmosphere. So it's about 80% of oxygen that is of the algae, micro and macro. And algae is the forests that of algae that grow on the coast, especially rocky coasts like Chile and Maine and, you know, Northern California, Alaska, Scotland, Japan. This is a places where the big kelp forests grow. It's the most productive ecosystems on Earth, you know, on every scale. All the little filamenty, you know, bryozoic that live on the surface of the blades. And then, of course, the diving seals and the whales and all the young fish who are in the nursery, the buffering of the waves. So just the kind of wild forest of algae, you know, is an extraordinary ecosystem. And where I moved in Maine, it's got extreme tides, 22-foot tides. So then on these spring tides, where it goes below, where, you know, there's a lifted skirt for you, but it's not lifted. It's like a, yeah, you pulled off the skirt. And this whole shimmering world is revealed, the undersea world. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in love with herbs and flowers and orchards and kind of the domesticated agrarian landscape. But then to get involved with this wild world of wet, wiggly wonder. Anyway, completely passionate. And, you know, move to the end of the world to be to be in relationship with this algae. And algae is also just an extraordinary place from which to see all of these kinds of crisis points, because it's this, because it's such an agent of ecological action. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a major driver of our animate earth. And so, you know, when you look at algae, then the story becomes algae blooms and algae explosion of the sargassum in the oceans that are caused by, especially the Atlantic Ocean, this Mississippi and Amazon deltas having been denuded of their tree cover and then rammed full of synthetic agrochemicals. And so then all that goes into the ocean. And of course, a lot of topsoil as well. And then the ocean responds and overproduces this floating golden forest of sargassum. And then that piles up on the beaches and, you know, causes some problems for some humans. I mean, major problems. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we pathologize the algae as, you know, toxic or invasive or... But then algae forests, you know, on the West Coast, for instance, suffered from the heat waves, the ocean heat waves. So something like 96% of the kelp forest off of Northern California perished. And then there was this kind of invasion of zombie urchins that were also slowing its recovery because of major ocean heat wave events. So you have a lot of phenomenology to look at in terms of how this very changing world relates to change and how algae figures into that. And proposals for large-scale farms of algae. I mean, right now, 97% of seaweed is grown in Asia, mostly for food. I mean, pretty much for food. There's algae is also used in fertilizers. And around us, that's a pretty big harvest from our ecosystem to go kind of remineralize animals. It was interesting to be in the back of a truck and I had the familiar smell of home, and there it was, Acadian seaweed from my bioregion is being fed to sheep in New Zealand. So there's, you know, the same thing we have with agriculture where we have to re-regionalize our supply chains is the same with algae. And we can harvest wild algae, absolutely, but we can't harvest it all. And then we should be farming some seaweed, but should we be farming 10,000 acres floating, autonomous, robotically tended monocultures for biofuels? Maybe not. You know, are there dangers that occur from domesticating a wild ecosystem that's in mega crisis? Yes. Do, you know, pests and diseases emerge when you create a monoculture of juvenile, highly concentrated, you know, ancient beings? Yeah, that is an absolute concern. And so the Seaweed Commons Coalition grew up during COVID as a kind of like potluck on Zoom for seaweed lovers to share our analysis and like what we were observing from our vantage point close to the ocean. You know, you, when the conferences are shut down and you know, you're not reading scientific papers, you can rely on people who live near a boat access ramp to tell you who's going out on the water and what's going on the water. And so that is a kind of a frontline community on algae. And that group of people then pulled together the white paper, Seaweed Commons white paper, and we have signatories. We have Dune Lankard in Alaska. We have Prenny Radigan in Ireland. We have Alice Waters in the kind of chef world. We have Louis Druel, who's the kind of king grandfather of Pacific, British Columbia seaweed. We basically pulled together a very strong set of signatories to affirm these principles of we must take a precautionary approach to domesticating algae. And we must do it learning the lessons from large-scale farming and land. And we must do it in ways that support the coastal livelihoods. Don't just go and extract from places that already lost their fish, that are really poor and remote, and just have a bunch of kind of outsider-owned, you know, big O companies come in, and which has been the pattern of salmon aquaculture for sure. Mm-hmm. Leaving a terrible legacy everywhere they go. So there's really good lessons to learn in the way that we approach a a regulatory environment. And what's great about algae is also it doesn't happen on private property. So from a, you know, just intellectually, it's a very gratifying, wobbly world to work in, because here's an actual commons, an actual legal commons. But many of the commons or commoners, the coastal stakeholders, but also everyone, you and I, we are all citizens, various countries. But we are actually stakeholders and could be participating in rulemaking to a greater extent than we are. And figuring out how to, you know, these are kind of severed pathways of citizen engagement with natural resource management decisions. And that's been the case all over in land where you have industry lobby groups running the policy. Mm-hmm. And here you have a situation with seaweed where there isn't a big industry yet, although they're coming really fast, you know, and people show up with $125 million in, you know, Spotify or Swipeify, or I forget who wanted to pre-purchase their carbon credits and
Stripe.
And Stripe, there we go. Swipe, whatever it is.
Stripe.
Stripe. They came in as running tide in Maine. It was like, whoa. Mm. You know, they've had a lot of pushback. And, I think probably some of the people who work inside there will go on to other things in seaweed and, you know, we'll all be friends in the end. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, there are problems with concentrated mega capital coming in to, you know, initiate sectors in that manner, and especially in the absence of rules. So, you know, the kind of egregious proposals that they're making are able to be made because there's inadequate constraints on the public, on a public trust resource. So anyway, it's just a kind of fascinating place on many levels. And we host every year since we've been there, a seaweed symposium, low tides, harvest. You know, you can come and meet the mermaids and, you know, wear wool socks, bring an extra pair, bring a thermos, and, you know, come and touch the algae yourself and get into relationship with this world. It also is easier with more people if we do it together. So I welcome you to come and visit in Maine if you want to. March, April, May, June, a little bit in July, but it goes, you know, it's better when it's young. Harvest it, cut it with a knife, bring it into a basket, haul it up the beach, hang it in a greenhouse to dry, and it turns into kind of like leather. Bag it, grind it. Sprinkle it on your toast. Very delicious.
Can't wait. I can't wait to visit myself. We'll put links in the show notes for your farm and all the different projects and resources, and definitely encourage people to check out the many publications and media and podcasts and just the prolific amount of things that you are touching and influencing and initiating and helping steward.
Yeah, plenty of winter reading.
Lots of winter reading as well.
And we're always looking for more writers for the New Farmer's Almanac. So we're coming into volume 7. So that's a kind of a request of the audience.
Any other active campaigns or things that you'd particularly want to shout out here?
Well, FarmHack is coming into the next phase, rebuild world. We're going to release the technological sovereignty manifesto that was first written in French by Atelier Paysan. We're going to have an English translation release in 2024. And FarmHack Lab in our little neck of the woods is being instantiated. Mm. But that's the kind of developer community for that is a small little informal roadie crew right now. And the goal is to grow a robust technical community. Mm. So that's an invitation.
Any final words, closing comments, reflections?
Well, thank you for the bold affirmation that this critical work will get its cash, you know, the needed cash. It feels aspirational sometimes, I'm sure to you as well.
Totally.
But one thing I can say from having observed the magnetism of this community of practice of restoration agriculture and sustainable agriculture and biodynamics and herbalism and all of these communities that we play in, is everyone is transformed by their participation. And you don't go back. You know, the genie is out of the bottle. Like you sink your teeth in and you never want to let go. So I think the invitation to the world of capital and the kind of larger, those not yet dirty, to, you know, get dirty and discover that you'll never want to go back.
Never. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Severin. To be honest, I could listen to her all day. As we said, there are links in the show notes for all of the different projects and resources that Severin mentioned and is working on. She is so prolific. You can also find more great conversations like this one on maearth.com. We invite you to like, share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.